All right, we are holding on page 86 in Shabbos, the second line of the wide lines. We talked yesterday about the about how Hashem says that He'll forgive the avodas of the Yidden, even if they're very severe, even if they're red like scarlet, even if like Hashanah Masduras, like years have been going by with them. And we talked about that Hashem at one point says to the Jewish people, go to the Ovis and they'll tell you all for what they did, for what you did. And the Jewish people say, we don't want to rely on them. They don't have enough rachmanos on us. Instead, we want to rely on you.
Didn't see it.
So now the Gemara continues. Now the Gemara continues in a similar vein with a similar drasha about the Ovis and the Averis of the Jewish people. So the Gemara says, Amar Rav Shmuel bar Nachmani, Amar Rav Yonasan, my dichtiv. What does it mean it says in the pasuk, Ki ata avinu, the Jewish people say, for you are our father, Ki Avraham lo yada'anu, Hashem, Avraham did not know us, the Yisrael lo yakiranu, and Yisrael, which is Yaakov, does not recognize us, Ata Hashem avinu, ge'aleinu v'goymer, you Hashem are our father, our redeemer. So what's going on over here? Why is Yitzchak missing? And who is the Kiata Avinu on the face of it? The Kiata Avinu at the beginning of the pasuk would seem to refer to Hashem, but then why is Yitzchak missing and what's going on over here? And why are we saying that Avraham and Yisrael don't recognize us? So there's going to come a point in the future when Hashem is going to say to Avraham, your children, your descendants, the Jewish people, have sinned to me. What should I do about it? And Oymer the Fonov, and Avraham says, Ribbon Shalom, Yimochwa Kedushas Shmecha, let them be wiped out, let them be erased for the Kedusha of your name. Now, does that mean that, so Rashi takes it at face value, that Avraham is going to say, look, since they did Averis, then when you punish them, then that'll make a Kiddush Hashem in the world, that people will see that you don't play favorites. On the other hand, Marsha and a lot of other Beforshim talk about the possibility that that the word Yimochu over here is kind of ambiguous. It can mean he means that the people should be wiped out, Chas v'Shalom. He can also mean that the Averis should be wiped out. But still, it's kind of ambiguous. So therefore, Omar, so Hashem says to himself, Emel el Yaakov, you know what, forget about asking Avraham, let me ask Yaakov. He had all the hardship of raising the 12 Shvatim, unlike Avraham, therefore maybe he'll daven for Rachmanus for them. Maybe, in other words, Avraham is not doesn't feel such an affinity to them, but maybe Yaakov will more so. So that's what we mean. So far we're saying Avraham lo yada'on. So he goes to Yaakov. He says the same thing. Let them be wiped out for the Kedusha of your name. Again, it can mean the Jewish people themselves. It can also mean the Averis, but still, Omar, so Hashem says, I see that there's no good reasoning among the elders, Avraham, and there's no good advice or understanding among the young ones. Neither Avraham nor Yaakov are fully standing up for the Jewish people. There is an interesting idea that Chidah brings from the Orach Chaim HaKadosh that says that actually the vote is, why would Avraham and Yaakov use such even if we're going to say like Marsha that it's ambiguous and they may mean to wipe out the Averis, why don't they say it flat out rather than saying it in such a convoluted way, which makes it seem as though they're asking Hashem to just go wipe out the Jewish people. So the Chidah brings from the Orach Chaim HaKadosh that they don't want to, in the sense that they figure eventually Hashem is going to ask Yitzchak, and we know what happens if the Beis Din is judging somebody and all of them declare that he's guilty, then he goes innocent. So they figure Yitzchak being Midas Agvura is more likely to take a harsh stance on them. So therefore, they figure like to play a game over here. We'll also say in a harsh way, and that way when Yitzchak joins in and says the same thing, then Hashem will have no choice but to exonerate the Jewish people. Nevertheless, Hashem is not happy with it, because why go in such a krumma way? Just go straight out and try to exonerate them. And after all, Avraham and Yaakov would be a majority against Yitzchak rather than doing like that.
Usually, yeah. the majority rules in a lot of these cases. If you have everybody saying,
yeah,
guilty, and yet now it goes free.
So the truth is, it's not so simple. I mean, there is that case. There's a possible call him a fiber. The first thing they all say is that he's guilty, then yeah, he goes free. There are, on the other hand, for example, if to begin with, Some of them find reasons to exonerate him, but then later on, by Gemara Din, they all find unanimously that he's guilty. Then, yeah, he's going to be guilty. But we're talking about at the beginning of the Din. I once heard. I'm not sure if this is true, but I heard a cute thing back when Scalia, the Chief Justice, Oliver Shalom, if you want to say on him, whatever, when he was still alive, one time they invited him to a symposium on Jewish law that was being, you know, he had Nassim Lewin and other big Jewish lawyers were there over there. Anyway, I came across this someplace that he gave a speech over there, and he was talking about this concept of shepaskel kulam l'chayva, that you have to exonerate the guy, and he's saying, how can you understand that in a legal sense? And he says, as Scalia says, that because we all know that when there's two Jews, there's three opinions. So if all of them see unanimously right from the start the guy's guilty, something's got to be wrong over here.
What was it? He said
shepaskel kulam l'chayva. And it starts out, if they start out, it's saying that the guy is guilty, then he walks free. So, well, yeah, that's a cute vote. That's a cute vote from an Italian brain, you know, whatever. Anyway, from a Goyish company. Anyway. Okay. So anyway, so Amalei LeYitzchak Banecha Chaturi. Now Hashem comes to Yitzchak and says, "Your children have sinned to me. What should I do about it?" And here Yitzchak stands up, is the one who stands up on behalf of the Jewish people. So there's a lot of different explanations in Mefarshim why Dafka Yitzchak does that. In fact, one interesting explanation is the same way, for example, as Avraham, who was the personification of Midas HaChesed, he was given a test involving sacrificing Yitzchak, which would go against his natural chesed, to see, is he going to do that for Hashem's sake? And he passed the test with flying colors. And the same way as, for example, Yaakov was Midas HaEmes, and yet his Nisyonis involved, for example, having to go over there with Lavan and be able to beat him at his own game. So in the same vein, then Yitzchak being Midas HaGvura, so he's given a test, is he going to stand up for the Jewish people with chesed? So there is such an explanation. There's various places where it talks about in Chassidus that the idea is that right now here in Olam Hazeh we see Gvura as being much lower than Chesed. We see that Chesed is something desirable and Gvura is something we usually want to stay away from. But the truth is Gvura has a higher source, Beruchnius, than Chesed does. La'asid Lover, that'll be revealed. So one aspect of that is now Yitzchak is standing up on behalf of the Jewish people in the way that Avraham and Yaakov are not. Related to that is also he's going to invoke the schus. The first thing he's going to invoke is the schus of the Jewish people saying Nasa before Nishma, where we talked about that in the Gemara the other day, and in particular Rabbi Levi Yitzchak, that his father explained that is an example of Gvura, the same way as the Malachim are Gibore Koyach, and they know that secret, the same way the Jewish people reach that. Therefore Yitzchak Taka has more of an affinity with that, and therefore he stands up to defend the Jewish people more than anybody else. Anyway, So Yitzchak starts by saying to Hashem to defend the Jewish people. First of all, he says, "Bonai v'loy bonecha." What do you mean? You're saying your sons have sinned? Are they only my sons? Aren't they your sons also? V'shashik dimel fanecha last nasa v'nishma. When they said nasa before nishma by Matan Torah, karosalahem nibachori. You Hashem called the Jewish people my firstborn son. Actually, to be exact, b'nibachori Yisrael. A few parashiyos earlier, Rashi explains, in other words, that when Hashem said that b'nibachori Yisrael, to tell Moshe, to tell Paro that Hashem knew in advance that they were going to say nasa before nishma. So therefore, already in token of that, he called them b'nei b'chori. Marashah also adds the point that originally the b'chorim was supposed to have the kahuna and the malchus. They lost that in the wake of the chetah egel. So therefore, when Hashem said b'nei b'chori Yisrael, that goes together with the fact that we said before they got two crowns, one for nasa and one for nishma, and those two crowns, Marashah explained earlier, referred to the crowns of kahuna and malchus. So it all fits together. Anyway, so you called them b'nei b'chori, achsha bonai v'loi b'necha. All of a sudden, what? Now, Hashem, you're saying they're only my sons, they're not your sons? So first of all, have rachmanas on them for that reason alone, because they're your children. Second of all, v'oid, furthermore, Yitzchak argues to Hashem, let's figure it out. Kamachatu, how much already could they have sinned? How much shnoisa shaladam? Let's begin with, how much does a person live on average? Shivim shana, a person on average, a person lives 70 years. Dal Estrim Delay Anshasalaihu. First of all, subtract 20 years, that Hashem, the Beis Din Shamayla, generally doesn't punish a person until he's 20 years old. The different Achronim talk about different, perhaps, exceptions to that. We find, for example, that Aaron Oinon were punished at a younger age, and we have other such examples, but by and large, the rule is that the Beis Din Shamayla doesn't punish a person till he's 20. So first of all, Poshul Hu Chamshin. So already you're down to only 50 years. Now, Dal Chav He Delei Levasa. Now, from that, you have to subtract 25 for the nighttime. At night, the person is sleeping, so he's not doing Averis. Actually, Ben Yehoyada says, what are you talking about? On the contrary, sometimes people do more Averis at night than they do during the day. So he says that actually what Yitzchak is arguing, he means, we don't just mean the physical night as when the sun is down and people are asleep. We mean the ruchniistic at night, the darkness and the confusion of Golus that causes people to be more susceptible to Averis than they otherwise would have. And therefore, therefore that's a mitigating factor. There's a similar thing, by the way, that Eber talks about in a hadron on Masechta Nida, which is actually a hadron on the entire Shas, Nida being the last Masechta of Gemara and Shas. The very last thing, almost the last section of Masechta Nida talks over there about the distinction between Nida and Zava, where we know that Nida is the expected kind of bleeding that a woman has, and Zava is unnatural, mid-cycle or whatever. And the Gemara brings up one of the Amoraim says to Rava, maybe we should say, maybe the Pasuk is implying that a woman is a nida only if the bleeding is by night, and a zava if it happens by day. And Rava tells him, Allah ha'amakra, that no, you have a Pasuk that tells us that not like that. It's not a matter of day or night. It's a matter of what point in the cycle she's at. So the Rebbe talks about the idea, a nida, when you think about it, the bleeding is a natural thing. It's part of the female condition. Therefore, that represents the kind of the fact that a person is more naturally, a person has a nefesh of Bahamas, a person has a body, therefore he's susceptible to Averis. On the other hand, then the azava, which is an unnatural kind of bleeding, represents like the person has a greater degree of Averis. So Shimi Ba'ashi over there in the Gemara is arguing, whatever the name was anyway, argues that maybe we should say that only whenever when would it be that a person is in the state of zava with all those extra Averis would only be when there's a greater gilui of the course and still they're doing Averis when there's daytime and yet they're doing Averis. And Rava tells him, no, Allah ha'amakra, the pasuk gives you a nesinas koyach that, or the other way around, that even at night, even when it's dark, even when you have the tremendous darkness of Golos, you don't necessarily have to be a zava. You could avoid that. So in a similar vein, Ben Yehoyada is saying over here that the nights we're talking about means the nights, the confusion and the darkness of Golos, a person is more susceptible to Averis, so therefore Yitzchak is saying to Hashem, give the Jewish people a break for that. So next, Poshul Lehu Chofei. So that leaves 25 years altogether, because you've taken away half of 50. Dal Tau Tisrei Upalga. Now from that itself, you have to subtract another 12 and a half years, Ditzaluye, doing that, during half of a person's time, say a person is davening, a person is eating, a person is going to the bathroom. So once you have that, altogether, the total amount of time, the average person maximum that he would have to do Averis in his lifetime would be 12 and a half years worth. So in other words, the bottom, and out of 70 years, that's already a minority. So Yitzchak says to Hashem, imata servil askolam, if you're willing to tolerate all of those Averis and forgive the Jewish people for them, mutab, then good. The imlav, paugalai or paugaloch. If not, then I'm willing to take half the burden on myself and you take this. And now we're down to 6 1/4 that you need to forgive the Jewish people for, and I'll take the other. The imtoma, pulu alai, even if you want to say, I should have to take it all on myself. Fine, I'm willing to do that. For korevis nafshi kamach, after all, I was mocked with myself before you by the Akedah. So therefore, so to speak, Hashem owes him one. So therefore, so he's going to use that schus on behalf of the Jewish people. So Maushal says, in other words, that we can distinguish between you have averis bein adam l'mokrim and you have averis bein adam l'chaveri. So Yitzchak is arguing when it comes down to splitting up the Averis, he says, you should be willing to forgive them for the ones Bein Adam L'Makim. And as far as the Bein Adam L'Chaveri, I'll take that on myself. I'll take the responsibility on myself. Or even all of them, even if you want to say that all a person's entire 12 and a half years, hypothetically, of Averis in his lifetime is all Bein Adam L'Makim. Nevertheless, I still have tremendous schus that I can take all of them, and therefore I'm willing to do that. Different other Mephoshim over here point out different other possibilities. Anaf Yosef points out, after all, a person is made up of a guf and a neshama. So first Yitzchak is saying that you, Hashem, should be willing to take, so to speak, the responsibility for half of the Averis, because after all, you have the, how Averis done, a person has to be a Neshama and a Guf. So fine, the Neshama comes from you, the Guf comes from me, so therefore you take the one that you take apart from the Neshama, and I'll take the responsibility for the Guf, and if not, then I'm willing to take all of it. Eitz Yosef also points out, in a different way of looking at it, there are two things, two major things that cause a person to be susceptible to Averis: his internal Yetzahara, and outside you have the Shibud Malchus, the various Goyim that were subjugated to, whether an actual subjugation or just that we live in their culture or whatever. And after all, Yitzchak says, listen, you know, I bear a certain degree of responsibility for that because I'm the one who gave Esav the bracha. So, and told him, when you have reason to complain, then you'll be able to break off the yoke of Yaakov from your neck. So therefore, he's saying, I'm willing to take half of it on myself, that you, Hashem, should take responsibility for half, because you put a Yetzirah in a person. I'm willing to take responsibility for the other half, because I'm the one who made the Shibud Malchus possible by giving the bracha to Esav. So,
is poverty also another one of those?
Poverty is related to those. When we're in Shibud Malchus, then often there's that. So therefore, so all told, then Yitzchak is standing up and then defending the Jewish people with everything he's got. Poschuva Amru, so now hearing this, the Jewish people start saying the beginning of the pasuk, Ki Ata Avinu, you are our father. So now, in other words, when we said at the beginning of the pasuk, Ki Ata Avinu, so far we have Ki Avraham lo yada'onu v'Yisrael la yakiranu, Avraham and Yisrael, which is Yaakov, didn't want to stand up on our behalf, but you, Yitzchak, did, so you really, more than the other of us, deserve to be called our father. But Yitzchak says to them, instead of praising me, you should be praising Hashem, who is after all the one who's forgiving your averes. And Yitzchak shows them Hashem with their own eyes. So therefore, now they lift up their eyes to Shemayim, and they say the end of the pasuk, Ata Hashem Avinu, you Hashem are our father, Gayalenu, our redeemer, Ma'olam Shmecha, your name has always existed. So now the pasuk over here is giving us the whole story in brief. They start off with that they're so grateful to Yitzchak that he stood up on our behalf. But Yitzchak himself tells them that no, the real Avinu is not me, but rather Hashem. Okay, talking about the tzaris of Golos that the Jewish people have gone through. And the fact that Hashem calls Bnei B'chori and all. So the Gemara mentions another point related to this. By rights, Yaakov should have gone down to Mitzrayim in iron chains. Meaning Hashem had decided there was going to be a Golos. And how do people go in Golos? Usually by being dragged there in chains. So by any logic, that should have happened. The Eibishter should have caused events to happen that Yaakov is going to be brought down there against his will. But his schus helped that it didn't happen that way, that he came down in an honorable way, that his son, the viceroy of Mitzrayim, comes and invites him as a guest of the state. Dichtiv, as the pasuk describes this, Hashem says, "B'chavlay adam emshechem." I pulled them along, referring to the Jewish people, I pulled them along with ropes of people, meaning, in other words, Rashi explains, because I had the love for them, like a person has for a fellow person, rather than for an animal, instead of putting them in chains, I pulled them along gently with ropes, with cords of love, referring to the love between Yaakov and Yosef. I acted to them like a person who lifts off the yoke from the cheeks of the animal, meaning Rashi explains that a person has an animal that's doing work for him and it has a yoke on its neck or and touching its cheeks, but he wants to give the animal a break. So he sets up a contraption over there to lift up the yoke. Rashi describes with boards and with sticks and whatever, so it's not resting quite so heavily on the animal's neck. Va'at elav oichil, and I inclined to him oichil maloshin lahochil, the strength to be able to I gave him the strength to be able to withstand the avodas perach. So we see from that pasuk, in other words, that Hashem is saying that I pulled them, but I pulled them with ropes and cords of love, like the way you would pull a person, rather than the way you pull an animal. Maharsha explains the drasha a little bit differently. He says, again, B'chavlei Adam refers to Yosef. Ba'avoyses Ava, again, refers to the love that Yaakov and Yosef had for each other. Now, usually you would have expected once Yosef finds out that Yaakov is still alive, what should happen? Yosef should come back to Eretz Canaan, to Yaakov. Instead, that's not how Hashem planned it. Hashem planned that they have to go into Golos Mitzrayim. Therefore, so what did Hashem do? So Hashem treated Yaakov, again, like you have an animal, you have a cow that's working, that has a yoke on its neck, but you want to be able to give it food. So you lift up the yoke off its neck so that it will be able to eat more easily. And then you may even have the food may be far away, so you bring the food. So you bring the food to it, You show it where to go to find the food. So in the same way, Hashem did for Yaakov that He showed him where the food is, so that he would come to Mitzrayim. So va'at elav oichil. The word oichil doesn't just mean, like Rashi says, the ability to bear the difficulties of Golos, but also oichil, meloshen oichil, that Hashem says, I inclined Yaakov to go in the right direction towards the food where there would be a guaranteed food supply in Mitzrayim. Okay. Further on, the Gemara continues talking about in the rest of the Perek more various kinds of things that if a person carries out X amount of something on Shabbos, then he's chayev, and less than that, he's potter. So the Mishnah, one of the things the Mishnah mentions is if a person carries out some iron. And the Mishnah says if even the smallest amount of iron, he'd be chayev, and the Gemara explains because you can use it to make the point of a goad. You have a goad is a long stick with a point at the end of it that you use to goad an animal to get it to go in the right direction. So therefore, even a tiny amount of iron would be useful for that. So then the Gemara digresses to mention another minimum shear involving iron, not as far as Shabbos, but as far as another deal. Tanabonon, ha'oimer ha'reolai barzel. If a person says, I obligate myself to donate iron for Beit HaKavayis, for the upkeep of the Beis HaMikdash. So he didn't say how much, what's the minimum amount he has to give. Acherim, which usually means the mayor, says, lo yifchis me'ama al'ama, the least he should give is a square 1 amma by 1 amma. So the question is, l'may chazir, what would you use a square 1 amma by 1 amma for? Befrat, in general, in the Beis HaMikdash, they didn't use iron. For the most part, it was made out of stone, and in some places out of wood, and it was plated wherever possible with gold and silver or whatever. So what would they use iron for? Rabbi Yosef, l'kalya odev. So Rabbi Yosef says they would use it for the kalya odev. This is, Rashi describes, they put sharp metal plates, an amma by an amma, with sharp edges, and also Rashi describes, they also had sharp nails embedded into them. They would cover the roof of the heichal with them. The point is, you don't want ravens to perch on the roof of the heichal, either because they're going to make it dirty with their waste, or in some places, Rashi explains, because they tend to eat carcasses and whatnot, they may drop off a piece of a mess or a piece of a nevela over there and make the area tameh. So therefore, you want to discourage them from landing over there. So therefore, you have this kalya odev to prevent them from landing. There's a few other different explanations among Rishonim and Achronim how exactly the kalya odev was made. Rashi mentions over here that there were square pieces as well as spikes. Some of the Rishonim learned that there were only spikes. There are Mephoshim who learned that it was more like a scarecrow that was meant to scare away the birds. Tosfos brings over here that the Aruch learns that they only needed that in the second Beis HaMikdash. In the first Beis HaMikdash, the Aruch learns they didn't need the Kalya Odev at all because the Kedusha of the first Beis HaMikdash was so great that no raven would even think of perching on the Heichal. On the other hand, Tosfos says that no, there's a Gemara in Moed Katan that implies that not. The Gemara talks about over there when they had the Chanukah Sabayis, why they did the Chanukah Sabayis when they did, a week before Sukkot, why didn't they delay and finish and wait until the Kalya Odev was finished and wait with putting up the Kalya Odev a little longer, and then they could have made the Chanukah Sabayis another time. So we see, in other words, that there was a Kalya Odev in the first Beis HaMikdash as well. Okay. So the Gemara says, V'ikadamri. Now others say, so the first version that we just had was that Achedim said the minimum is an amma by an amma, but Achedim didn't specify why that is. And Rabbi Yosef comes and explains it's for the Kalya Odev. V'ikadamri. Others say the discussion went the other way around. Achedim omim lo yifchas mikalya odev, that the amount of iron that a person donates to the Beis HaMikdash when he says harei alai barzel should not be less than the amount that can be used for a kalya odev, v'kama. So what would that be? Amar Rabbi Yosef, amma al amma, that it would be 1 amma by 1 amma. So according to that second version, Achedim are telling us the purpose of it, and Rabbi Yosef is telling us the minimum amount, whereas according to the previous version, it was the other way around. Okay. Hamatznia perek asiri. The subject of this perek is more dinim about carrying on Shabbos. In what case is a person chayev, in what case is a person potter, and various details like that. So the Mishnah mentions that the Mishnah mentions that if a person carries something in his whether in his right hand or in his left hand or on his shoulder or whatever, then he's chayev because those are all normal ways of carrying. So now the Gemara says, "Amar Rabbi Elazar, hamotzi masu l'mayla me'asar tefachim." If a person carries out something on Shabbos higher than 10 tefachim, meaning Rashi describes, we don't mean that it's on his shoulder. If it was on his shoulder, then we already have Mishnah telling us he's chayev. What we mean is he's holding it in the air and walking along the street and carrying it above ten tefachim the whole time. Rashi points out, by the way, later on in the Masechta, it talks about that if a person throws something and it lands higher than 10 tefachim in Rishas Rabim, he'd be potter, because above 10 tefachim is considered makom patur, but here when he's carrying it in Rishas Rabim, then that's different than he's chayev. And the reason is, because we're going to learn, as he's going to say, because that's the way the B'nai Kahos would carry the Kalim of the Mishkan, and as we know, everything, all the Malachas of Shabbos, we learn from what they did in the Mishkan. The Chazon Ish actually gives a logical svara behind it. He says, because after all, when you're holding it in your hand, your feet are standing in Rosh Hashanah, so therefore your hand can be considered an extension of Rosh Hashanah, even though it's above 10 tefachim. Anyway, so Rabbi Elazar says, a person carries like that chayev, shekein masa b'nei kohos, because that is how the b'nei kohos carried the kalim of the Mishkan. So, masa b'nei kohos menolon, where indeed do we know that the b'nei kohos necessarily were carrying the kalim higher than 10 tefachim off the ground? So like this, we have to start with Dichtiv. Alam Mishkan v'alam Mizbeach Sovi. The Pasuk describes that the curtains of the Azorah went around the Mishkan and around the Mizbeach all around. So Makish Mizbeach l'Mishkan, by saying it that way, the Pasuk is implying that there's a similarity between the Mizbeach and the Mishkan. Ma Mishkan Eser Amos, just like the Mishkan was 10 Amos tall, as the Gemara is going to establish in a second. Af Mizbeach Eser Amos, the same way the Mizbeach was also 10 Amos tall. Meaning, the reason why we need to know that is because, after all, the Pasuk in Parashas Truma, when it talks about building the Mizbeach, it says it's only 3 amos tall. And in fact, there is a Tana who holds, I think Rabbi Yossi holds that that's what it was. It really was only 3 amos top to bottom. But the other Tana, I think Rabbi Yehuda, says that it was 10, and he learns from this Hekish that we're talking about over here, and he explains, Rashi says, the 3 amos means from the Soviv to the top of the Mizbeach was 3 amos, the ledge around the Mizbeach, the Kohenim would walk around on that ledge when they're daubing the blood of the Chatas on the corners, from there to the top of the Mizbeach was 3 amos, but then he had 7 amos below that. Anyway. So the Mizbeach was 10 Amos, and Umishkan Gufay Minolon. Now, so the point is, the Mishkan was carried by B'nai Gershon and B'nai Merari. We want to focus on the Mizbeach, because the Mizbeach was carried by B'nai Kohos. So after we establish that the Mishkan and the Mizbeach were both 10 Amos tall, then we'll get back to the proof. Umishkan Gufay Minolon, where do we know the Mishkan itself was 10 Amos tall? Dichtiv Eser Amos Urach HaKodesh, because the Pasuk says that each of the Kroshim was 10 Amos long. Now, since they were Atzei Shittim Oimdim, All of the beams of the Mishkan were standing up straight. Rashi mentions on the Pasuk, it wasn't built like a boat with one beam on the ground and then another one on top of it and so forth. Rather, they were vertical beams, one next to the other. So therefore, the length of the beam is the height of the building. So if the beams are 10 amas tall, then that means the height of the Mishkan building is 10 amas tall. And Uchtiv Vayifris HaSa'ol HaMishkan. Now, when it talks about putting up the Mishkan, it says that Moshe spread out the tent, meaning the curtains of the Urias Izim, over the Mishkan. V'Omer Rav, Moshe Rabbeinu Porse, and Rav says that means Moshe himself spread it out. From there you learn that the Leviim, Moshe was a Levi after all, were 10 Amos tall. The point being, in other words, since we're saying the Mishkan was 10 Amos tall, and Moshe was able to spread out the curtains over it himself, and the Mefarshim point out, you can't say he stood on a ladder or something, because nowhere in all of the description of all of the equipment of the Mishkan, nowhere does it mention ladders. So therefore, we have to understand there weren't any ladders necessary, and Moshe was able to put it up and take it down himself. So therefore, you have to be 10 amos tall. Mefarshim also point out, you can't say, let's say he was 9 amos tall and he reached above his head, because then he wouldn't be able to smooth out the curtains properly. It means that he really was 10 amos tall.
About
15 feet, right? Between 15 and 20 feet. So therefore, so we assume at this point that not only Moshe was 10 amos tall, but also the other Levim. Now, Ugmiri, so far we have, in other words, that the Levim were 10 Amos tall. We establish now that the Mizbeach HaChitzen was also 10 Amos tall, we said. Now, Ugmiri, now we have, we know for a fact, the Chot Tuna, the Midli B'Moitis, whenever you're carrying a burden using carrying poles, which the Mizbeach was, the Mizbeach had Badim attached to it, and they carried it using that, tilta mala'el, tshrei tilti mala'tachas. You usually have one third of the burden is above the poles, and two thirds of it is below. Now, of course, the Bnei Kohath carried the kelim on their shoulders. You have in Parshas Nasai when the Nasiim donated oxen and wagons. The pasuk makes a point of mentioning the Bnei Kohath lo nasin. He didn't give any of them to Bnei Kohath because they have to carry all the kelim on their shoulders. So therefore, it would come out that the mizbeach is 10 amos tall. So they're carrying in such a way that approximately three and one third amos is above the poles, meaning above their shoulders, and the other six and two thirds amos is below it. Since they themselves were 10 amos tall, then that means you have around 3 amos and a little bit between the bottom of the mizbeach and the ground. Now there are 6 tefachim to an amma. So therefore, so that comes out. So the bottom of the mizbeach was around 18 or 20 tefachim off the ground, which is a lot more than 10 tefachim. So there you go. There we see that in the Mishkan, they were carrying things above 10 tefachim from the ground, and that's considered carrying. So Rishtakov, David Midlatova, so it comes out that it was raised well more than 10 tefachim off the ground. Or the Gemara says, V'yiboyseima, or I can give you another way of learning it. Rashi says, because after all, you could say, look, what if the Levim were only 7 amos tall, let's say. So then you would have, making the same calculation, you would say that from the poles to the bottom of the Mizbeach is 6 and 2 thirds amos. Say the Levim were only 7 amos tall, then you only have 4 tefachim between the bottom of the Mizbeach and the ground. So that's not necessarily a valid proof that carrying above 10 tefachim is called carrying. Rather, we can learn from the Arim. The Omamar, Oren Tishav Achapodas Tefach, we learn elsewhere in Shas, the Oren itself was 9 tefachim tall. You have actually in a few places in Shas, Machlokas, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Meir, about the Amos that were used for the Kelim of the Mishkan. Were they regular Amos of 6 tefachim, or that's Rabbi Meir, or Rabbi Yehuda says that the ones for Kelim were actually shorter ones of 5 tefachim. Anyway, even according to Rabbi Meir, then the Oren was 9 tefachim tall, because the Pasuk says it was an Amma and a half tall, an Amma and a half is 9 tefachim. The kapodas tefach, the kapodas itself was another tefach thick, hare kanasora. So therefore you have from the bottom of the oren until the top of it, not counting the kruvim, is 10 tefachim. Ugmiri, and again, like we said before, to call tuna the midli mimotus, whenever you're carrying a burden with poles, and the oren also had poles, tilta mela'el, tre tilta mela'ra, one third is above the poles, two thirds is below. Ishtakas, the lamayla ma'asora, have a koi. So again, it comes out, even if you were to say that the Levium were a normal human height of 3 amos, still 3 amos is 18 tefachim. Only about 6 and 2 thirds tefachim of the Aron are hanging below their shoulders. So it comes out, the bottom of the Aron is 11 tefachim and change off the ground. So there you go, it was above more than 10 tefachim. So that's a solid proof, because the Levium were definitely at least normal height of 3 amos. Yeah, by the way, in a few places in Shas where Rashi and Tosfos argue, when we say that we say in a number of places in Shas that a shiur mikveh is 3 amos tall because it has to fit a person's entire body, does that mean that a person is 3 amos up to and including their head, or do we mean 3 amos up to and including their shoulders, and then above that you have their head as well? And why does it work with a mikveh? Because when you go into a mikveh, your body is displacing some of the water goes upward, and therefore there's enough of it to cover your head. So it's machlokas Rashi and Tosfos in a few places in Shas. Here it would work either way, whether you say that 3 amos is their total height, or whether you say that whether you say 3 amos up to the shoulders. Either way, it works out mathematically.
Up to the shoulders is better. It sounds a little short, 3 amos. I'm 6 feet tall.
So it depends how you look at it. You know, of course, that there are different opinions what amos are in modern measurements. In particular, you have the two famous shittas, Rabbi Avraham Chaim Noah and Chazon Ish, where Rabbi Avraham Chaim Noah makes an amma to be about a foot and a half, 19 inches about, and the Chazon Ish makes it to be more like 24 inches. So it could be actually the opinion that says that 3 amos is from head to toe would fit better with the Chazon Ish's opinion. So therefore, that comes out to around 6 feet. Whereas the opinion that's until the shoulders maybe would work out better with Rabbi Avraham Chaim Noah's opinion, then 3 amos would amount to about 4 feet 9 inches. And then once you add the height of the person's neck and head, then you have closer to 6 feet. So it could be that it's related to that point. Anyway. So whatever the case, we've shown that the Levium carried at least some of the Kelim of the Mishkan more than 10 tefachim above the ground, and that's considered carrying. And from that, we learn that carrying something above 10 amos in Rishasad, above 10 tefachim in Rishasad Abim is considered carrying, and a person is chayav for it. So the Gemara goes on to talk about in the sugya why did we not continue with the proof from the Levium carrying the Mizbeach? The Gemara says, because we said before, we assumed before that if Moshe was 10 amas tall, and we showed that from the Pesukim, we assumed that all the Levium were also, but the Gemara is saying not necessarily. Maybe Moshe was special because Ein Ashchina Shoda, the Shchina does not rest, El Al Chocham, only on a person who is a Chocham, or wise in Torah, Gibber, who's strong, but Oshu and rich, Uval Koima, and who's tall. The idea behind it, Mephoshim explained, is basically because such a person, people look up, first of all, people look up to such a person. So that way, they're more likely to respect what he has to say in Hashem's name. And also, there's the idea, for example, that way, he's not afraid of people. Many times, as we know, throughout Tanakh, the Nevi'im were not always saying things that people wanted to hear. So like this, at least if he's a gibber and an usher or never, he has less reason to be afraid of them and therefore to hold back. So therefore, he's less likely to hold back what Hashem is telling him. The Rambam learns that maybe this is only, we're talking about the kviyos, maybe derech arai, maybe as a temporary thing, the shchina could rest, the person could be a navi, even if he doesn't have all these qualities, but we mean at least for a long-term navi, like Moshe Rabbeinu was. So we see, in other words, that Moshe had to be baal koima, he had to be tall, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the rest of the levium were the same way. So chacham, where do we see that a novi has to be a chacham? Dichtiv, you have a pasuk. Iu giborim ola chacham. The wise man, referring to Moshe Rabbeinu, went up to the city of the mighty ones, meaning he went up to Shemayim, like we learned before. Vayored oz mivtecha, and he brought down the strength that we can rely on, meaning the strength of the Torah. So we see that Moshe was a chacham. And we learn that the other Nevi'im have to be like him as well. Navi Okim Lahem Mekerev Achayim Kamoicha. So therefore, other Nevi'im have to be Chachamim as well. Dibur Baal Koima. Where do we see that Moshe was strong and tall? The Amar Rav. Because we just said before, Moshe Rabbeinu, Esa Amas, Hoysa Kemase, that he was 10 Amas tall. Because we said he spread out the curtains on the Mishkan. The truth is, actually, the Gemara in Nedarim says maybe that's not a solid proof. Maybe Moshe was tall, but skinny and weak. So rather, the Gemara ends up bringing a different proof over there, the fact that he was holding the luchos, which weighed an enormous amount, and threw them down forcefully, that shows that he was strong. But here, the Gemara is just being the katzer in it. And Oshu, how do we know Moshe was rich? Dichtib, psal lacha, because Hashem tells him, carve out the luchos, and mishalcha, meaning it's going to be from your own sapphire, so we see that, and Hashem let him keep the chips. So therefore, we see Moshe was rich. So therefore, the point is that Moshe was tall, that doesn't show necessarily that all the other Levium were tall as well. Okay, Piska, quoting from the Mishnah. The Mishnah describes, as a chai b'mitter, potter afala mitter, if a person carries out on Shabbos a living person in a bed, then not only is he potter for carrying the person, he's even potter for carrying the bed, because the bed is tuffel to the person. So the Gemara asks, now, most the Gemara mentions at the beginning of the Masechta, by the way, almost all cases in Masechta Shabbos, where it says that somebody is potter, it still means it's also drabana. So don't go carrying people out in beds on Shabbos. It would be mutter, and therefore a person's not going to be chayv chatas or skiller or what have you for it. Anyway, so the Gemara says, Lema masnisin Rab Nosanhi v'loy Rabbanan. Would we have to say then that our Mishnah is going only according to Rab Nosan and not according to the Chacham? The Tanya, Hamoitzi behema chayv v'oflo shesarabim. If a person carries out a domestic animal or a wild animal or a bird to Rosh Hashanah, ben chayin ben shchotin, whether they're alive or whether they're shechted, chayiv, and he'd be chayiv for carrying on Shabbos, Rav Nosson omer al shchotin chayiv al chayin potter, but Rav Nosson says if they're shechted, he's chayiv, because of course then they can't move, if like anything else the person might carry on Shabbos, but if they're live, then they're potter. Shach chayin no say satsman, because a living creature carries itself, meaning in other words, when you carry a living creature, and it seems like Rav Nosson is referring to animals as well, it adjusts its weight. It adjusts its weight in such a way that you're not feeling the entire weight of it when you're carrying it. It helps. It distributes its weight so that you're carrying it, so you're having an easier time carrying it. Tosfos discusses in that case, then why would that make a person potter? Why would that make a person potter for carrying it? And the answer is, Tosfos says, because again, we have to learn everything from the Mishkan. In the Mishkan, we never find that they carried living animals or living people. All the animals that any animals that they needed, for example, the Elim and the Tchoshim would walk on their own feet. As far as the Chilazim, they would they'd squeeze out the dye from it before it even dies. So there was never really a time when they're carrying around living creatures. So therefore, Rav Nosson is saying, based on that precedent, then a person is potter on Shabbos for carrying living creatures. So now, our Mishnah is saying that only if a person is carrying a person in a bed, he's potter. According to the Nasan, he should be potter also for carrying a living animal. However, the Gemara says, Omar Rabba, or the other way around, actually, we would say, the Gemara is assuming the other way around, that only Rav Nosson would say, Chai Nosei Tzatzmai, the Chachamim disagree with that concept. So the Chachamim would say that a person is Chayiv for carrying a living creature. The same way as they're saying a person would be Chayiv for carrying a living animal, but Pashtus, we would assume they're a person, they would also say a person is Chayiv for carrying a living person. So if the Mishnah is saying he's Potter, it would be only according to Rav Nosson. But Omar Rabba or Rava, Afilo Tamer Rabbanon. No, you could even say that the Mishnah goes according to the Chachamim. Ad kan like pligu Rabbanon alei the Rav Nosson ela bebehema chayev oiv. Because you should know the Chachamim disagree with Rav Nosson only when it comes to animals. De meshavati nafshayu, because they stiffen themselves. Meshavati meloshin shavet hazav, like they'll make themselves stiff and make themselves heavy, and therefore you're going to have a harder time carrying them. So the Chachamim say, you can't say then when you're carrying an animal that it's making it any easier for you to carry it, adrabah, it's going to resist. Aval odam chai, the noisei asatz, remember, a living person carries themselves, and they, in other words, they help distribute their weight. I feel that Rabbanan Moidu, that even the Chachamim might agree that that's not really considered carrying, and therefore he'd be potter for doing that on Shabbos. And again, even if he's carrying a bed along with him. Elsewhere, the Gemara talks. So now the Gemara continues. Amar Rabbi Yechan, umoidir Rav Nosson b'kafos. Now, however, Rav Nosson would agree if the person is tied up, then whether we're talking about an animal or whether we're talking about a person, then the one who's carrying would be chayev, because then you can't say they're adjusting their weight because they're tied up. So the Gemara says, "Amalei Rav Adar b'masna la'abaya v'hohani pausoi." What about if you're going to say like that? What about the Persian nobleman, the commander Kfisi Yomu? They're in effect like someone tied up, because Rashi describes when they ride around, they wear these big flowing clothes, and they're too finicky and too delicate to walk on the ground. So they always ride horses everywhere. So in effect, they're almost like a person who's tied up, who can't carry themselves, and yet. Yet Rav Yochanan tells us that Ben Beseira in a Mishnah and Rav Nosson are saying basically the same thing. The Gemara tells us in Psachim and in Avodah Zarah that there's dinim. You're not allowed to sell animals that can be used for work on that might conceivably be used for work on Shabbos. You're not allowed to sell them to a goy, because the goy may end up doing work with them on Shabbos. However, Ben Beseira allows you to sell a horse to a goy, because the horse. So Rashi explains based on the Gemara's over there that we're talking about a horse that's not used so much for people to ride on, but rather when you're catching birds, you're putting them you're putting the net full of birds on the horse. And Rav Yochanan is saying that Ben Beseira and Rav Nosson are saying effectively the same thing. So you see that Rav Nosson din would apply even if the animals are tied up, just like the birds are tied up. Now on the other hand, it sounds like otherwise Ben Beseira would say that a horse that's going to be ridden on by somebody, you're also to sell to a goy. Now, even that means even a Persian, even though the Persians themselves ride around on their horses all the time, and they're in effect considered tied up. So he answers, Abaya answers, Hosim Romus Rucho Hu Denokalu. The answer is there, it's not really that they can't walk around, they're just they're Gaivadika people. Dahu Pardashka, we have the example of a certain Persian nobleman, Rashi translates Pardashka as Saudiite, a soldier, the Rosach Malka Ilabe. The king was angry at him, Veroh Tlosa Parasi Bakare, and he ran 3 parasa, which is about 8 miles or so, on his bare feet. So you see, these guys are perfectly capable of walking and running when they need to. It's just that most of the time they're too proud to. So therefore, you can't call them kofos. You can say they have the power to be noisei satsmai, and therefore you might be able to sell. Therefore you'd have the respective dinim of selling them a horse to ride on, even though they might ride on Shabbos, because it wouldn't be a malacha d'oraisa. Okay, yom yom Mashiach Gola, Yud Zayin Iyar. Right away at the beginning of Ma'aseh Bereishis, the pasuk says, "V'ruach elokim merachefes al pnei ha'mayim." The spirit of Hashem was hovering over the water, and the Medrash said that the ruach elokim is zer ruchay shel malach ha'mashiach, is the spirit of Mashiach. And only after that does it say, "Vayir elokim yihir vayihir." So even before light was created, you already had ruchay shel malach ha'mashiach. Halacha. we were talking about the halachas of things that you see and make a bracha on. So we talked about yesterday about lightning and shooting stars and whatnot. So as far as thunder, if you hear it separately than the lightning, you saw the lightning, then afterwards you heard the thunder, then you say on the lightning and shekach grasim alaolam on the thunder. If you see them together, then you just make the one bracha oisamais bereshis. Or the Alter Rebbe says, if you want, you could say shekach grasim alaolam for the two of them. And then same thing. If you hear the thunder, you also don't make a separate bracha on it because it's covered by the bracha on the lightning. And also these brachas you only make only if you said them. If you saw the lightning, you waited more than then you can't say the bracha anymore. The Alter Rebbe says you would say it without shame of malchus.
Does the lightning ever come first and then the thunder?
The lightning usually comes first and then the thunder. Sometimes. So then you would say, if you hear them more than Teich Kedibur apart, then you'd say two separate brachas for them. But sometimes you have the storm is very close and the thunder comes at about the same time as the lightning or Teich Kedibur, then you'd say one bracha and it would cover both.
How about the other way around?
You never have the lightning. You never have the thunder before the lightning. No. Sound travels slower than light. Yeah.